The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Nick is the genderqueer, self-described man-girl and degenerate PhD dropout behind the smart and funny YouTube channel ContraPoints. Nick is also the guest on this week's podcast. It's Wednesday, April 18th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This is part one of a two-part conversation. If you'd like to hear the second half, think about joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes consists of the second half of interviews from Zero Books, sometimes features conversations with our readers and editors about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from Zero Books authors or staff. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with authors from Zero Books and others. You might also stop by the Zero Books website and purchase a book on critical theory. Recommended titles include Uncertain Futures, Alfie Bound's interview with Sreco Horvat, and the late Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism. So go to zero-books.com. If I said Zero Books enough? In this episode, you'll hear The Struts covering David Bowie's hit Rebel Rebel, some controversial statements on transgender politics from Slavoj Žižek, and a sped-up clip of Justin Bieber's Love Me. Right now, you're listening to an instrumental cover of The Kinks. It's Lola. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Nick and I discuss contrary points on identity.
I've been sort of participating on YouTube on and off for about 9 years now. So I started, you know, I was just 19 or something back in 2008. And I was, even back then, people like The Amazing Atheist were around. And, you know, at the time it was mostly about debunking creationism and this kind of thing. But anyway, I sort of looked back on it last year and saw that many of these people and many of these channels had been converted or replaced into channels that were mostly about this kind of like ranting against feminism and against Black Lives Matter. A year ago, the YouTube was much, much more, I think the situation was grimmer than it is now, because it was really just only dominated by this one sort of much more unified than it is now, reactionary kind of voice that was sort of mostly focused on complaining about feminism. And I decided, I thought I could be someone who was in a good position to start a channel that kind of was supposed to be sort of the antidote to that, or at least a counterbalance.
So what do you think it was that moved people like The Amazing Atheist to this anti-social justice warrior position? How did that happen? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think there's a couple things. And one of the things is that actually this is something that was always there in the first place. I think that when kind of the heyday of YouTube's atheism, skepticism, it was almost all men. I mean, there were some women, but there was a casual misogyny that really prevailed, and it sort of wasn't discussed a whole lot. You know, I knew behind the scenes there was bad stuff happening. The women involved were being, you know, revenge porned and like all this kind of stuff that didn't necessarily rise to the surface as a topic of discussion, but it was going on. Then in, I think, 2011, there was an incident at an atheism conference where Rebecca Watson, who runs a YouTube channel called The Skeptic, I think, and she was, I guess, a guy kind of like hit on her in an elevator. I actually don't remember exactly the details of the story. But
This is called Elevator Gate.
Yes, that's right. So she essentially made a YouTube video like describing this experience and complaining about the atmosphere at these conferences. And in response, I know Richard Dawkins, for instance, tweeted, Western women here are complaining about compliments while women in Saudi Arabia are, that line. There was a big thing that erupted over that, and the community kind of split in two. And, the feminist side of this mostly went off YouTube into other places. And then, a couple years later, the whole Gamergate thing happened. And then YouTube was a big locus of that. So I think that sort of set the stage.
The anti-social justice movement on YouTube has like a full range of politics. I mean, The Amazing Atheist is not – I mean, in some ways, he's an ally to progressives. Not in every way, but I mean, he's a liberal. He supported Bernie Sanders. He supported Hillary Clinton. He's a libertarian, liberal, progressive in his politics. That's how he identifies.
Yes.
Then someone like Black Pigeon Speaks – that guy is, and he's got 100,000 subscribers. This is or more, and he's a friggin' fascist.
Yeah, he's promoting outright fascism. Yes. Yeah.
So, how do you explain that?
That's a good question. I mean, when I came on YouTube last year, things have changed a lot in the last year. So when I first came on, the idea of an anti-SJW YouTuber was I don't even really talk about anti-SJW YouTubers anymore because they've split into so many different things. So there was a much more unified idea of what it was to be an anti-SJW YouTuber. I mean, mostly that you would just make these kind of repetitive videos complaining again and again about feminism. And there was always different ways of doing that. Like, The Amazing Atheist was more of the complaining about Anita Sarkeesian genre, whereas even at the time, Black Pigeon Speaks was way off the deep end, talking about how women will be the downfall of Western civilization.
That's my favorite Black Pigeon Speaks video. It's like, if you watch that, guys, and you continue watching this channel, really, ask yourself why you're not getting laid. Come on now.
Yeah, it's very retrograde stuff. But yeah, I think that in a lot of ways, Trump and the rise of the alt-right, or at least awareness of the alt-right, really kind of splintered all those people into different factions. So like you say, you have The Amazing Atheist who, on paper at least is a liberal. And I say on paper simply because I think that, if you accuse him of being reactionary or conservative, he will say, well, I'm not those things. I support abortion rights. I vote for Bernie Sanders and so on. But I find that in terms of the content of his actual videos, it's mostly spent complaining about progressive movements and not a lot spent on actually championing progressive causes. But you're right that he I don't think he comes from a place of sympathy for fascism at all. Whereas alt-right YouTubers and their sort of alt-light people. So, alt-right, I would say that Black Pigeon Speaks is outright alt-right. It's like there's a, refugee rape rampage destroying Europe, putting women in power is the collapse of civilization. But then you have people like Lauren Southern and Paul Joseph Watson who...
Now, I don't know if they're really YouTubers though, because they have YouTube channels, but Alex Jones is a radio personality and then a podcaster.
I would call Paul Joseph Watson is his kind of YouTube bulldog. Okay. I would say Paul Joseph Watson. I would say is mainly a YouTuber. I mean, he's under the employ of InfoWars, but I say he's most known for the YouTube videos. And he would distance himself from, for instance, the like explicit anti-Semitism that is sort of the hallmark of, okay, now you're in the quote, now you're really all right if you're talking about the Jews. But Paul Joseph Watson, it's a lot of the same thoughts.
But that was around Alex Jones has been around forever, and he's always been dancing on this line between being, the Elder Zion conspiracy nut and not, right? He's just sort of using code language around it, forever. Go on.
But I guess with him, like it's you know, at least a decade ago, it was more of the kind of like, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, you know, anti-vaccines, like this that era of conspiracy theorizing. Whereas in the Trump era, it came to be, I think the weird thing is Trump becoming the champion of many of these people, including Alex Jones, including the alt-right, that sort of gave them a political focus, or gave InfoWars, for instance, a political focus that it previously didn't have. I'd never seen them, you know, outright championing someone. I guess maybe Ron Paul back in 2012, but a candidate who was a plausible candidate to win and then did win. That's never happened
before.
Stupid
move. So, dumb move.
Yes. Yes.
Just in terms of their marketing, because that's.
I absolutely agree. And of course, they're now all splitting with Trump over this bomb strike in Syria. So it's interesting to watch that marriage fall apart.
I feel like the fascists came along, took advantage of an anti-social justice sentiment that was formulating not, to my feeling, is a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it was not formulating out of misogyny or racism, but was being shaped by an online culture which was dysfunctional. Not that it was dysfunctional only on the side of the social justice warriors at all, but just that the conversations online, the way that they operated, especially in social media spaces, are all about identity formation. So what you're doing is you're presenting yourself, you're presenting your perspective, and you're defending your identity. Regardless of what it is, whether it's a Christian identity, a comic book nerd, a feminist, polymorphous, gender fluid person, whatever it is, that's what you're presenting. And then you defend that. And when you mix in social justice politics with that, you have an excuse to be more strident, I think.
So I guess that one thing I would take issue with that characterization is that I just think that there's a difference between these identities. Like I just don't know that being a comic book nerd is a legitimate political identity in the way that being a woman or feminist is.
See,
you know,
I wouldn't
what I mean?
Say that being a woman is a legitimate political identity either. Maybe being a feminist is, but even there you're talking that breaks down in a hundred different ways too. So having a,
well, I guess what I say is that like it's clear to me at least like what women's political interests are in terms of reproductive rights, in terms of workplace discrimination, in terms of equal pay, in terms of these kind. You know, it's clear to me what these issues are. Whereas it's not clear to me what are the political interests of a gamer or a comic book nerd
In the realm of reproductive rights, clearly there is a commonality, although it's not universal that everyone shares. All women share that opinion about it, but I see that that's in their every woman's, you know, interest to have access to birth control of all months.
At least that makes sense to make a political identity
but,
about it. Yeah.
As far as like equal pay and workplace treatment, I think that if you don't take into account the difference between people who work for a living and people who own the means of production, then, you know, then that doesn't make any sense. There's not a commonality in most of those workplace issues amongst all women. And not even against all women who work, but because there's so many, that's the really scary thing for some so-called Marxists is that the working class is set against itself, that there are gradations there. So I don't see there being a simple feminist politics that everyone who calls themselves a feminist shares. And,
oh no, there isn't. There isn't.
Right. Yeah. To think of it as a political identity, I think maybe we shouldn't even have political identities at all. But, because if we have a political identity, that means that we identify so fully with our politics, we can't change it. You know, we, often enough, if you have a political identity, your politics may not even cohere because you have just, you know, a bunch of stuff that feels good to you that you believe. So yeah, that was my complaint about social media, is that it's aimed at presenting identities rather than presenting ideas or creating a space for politics.
Well, I guess I think that the identities are useful because the identities are not necessarily, you know, once they become political, there's a set of issues that's attached for them. And I think it makes sense for people who are directly affected by those issues to be the primary advocates sure. for them. So, but I, so I'm just, let me just try to get a handle on like what, the what angle you're criticizing this from. I mean, so is your thought, so are you coming there from this kind of, from kind of like a Marxist mm-hmm. perspective where you think that it would, because in a sense, like, isn't the like working class, for instance, also kind of a political identity?
It's a relationship to the in the economy. And the really unfortunate thing for Marxists, especially if you look back on the 20th century, not knowing how to get out from under capitalism means that you don't have a clear politics. So it's a challenge to your identity more than it is an identity. I mean, like the working class, their project mm-hmm. would be to get rid of being the whole working class as an identity. So, you know,
yes.
So yeah, there's not a, you know, a working class person living in Portland and a working class person living in Bangladesh probably don't have a common identity. They have a common class, but they don't have a common identity.
Yes. Well, but they may, yeah, but they may have in some respect common interests.
They do.
Yeah.
That's right. But that's not the same thing as an identity, right? I mean, there are cultural interests and there are economic interests. So, and sometimes cultural interests trump, not to be punny, economic mm-hmm. interests. People are complex.
So the buzzword is intersectionality, which is supposed to characterize the need to consider that these identities can't just be these like atomistic like formations right. That are the whole basis of your politics, because they interact with each other in all these complicated ways. And a lot of people, you know, may be conflicted between multiple identities. And I think that one of the axes that's supposed to be in play is the economic one. And that is actually not, I think it sounds like what you might want to, what part of your complaint might be is that that is not talked about as much online.
In the circles I run in online, it's talked about all the time. So I wouldn't really complain about that exactly. It's not about talking about it more. It's about understanding, like for instance, understanding that the working class isn't primarily an identity, that if there's a culture of the working class, it's secondary and it can change. So like you, when you're struggling for radical change, you're not struggling for better conditions, basically for your identity group. Mm-hmm. You're struggling to change the very system that sets up these categories. Race is a similar thing. Like white and black is a distinction which should be eliminated, I think, because it's relatively new. It comes out of chattel slavery. There is no white identity, as you point out in one of your videos. So that whole, like, to overcome racism, part of it would be the abolition of these categories. But you can't do it just by saying, you know, stop believing in these categories.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't just say abolish the race and gender or whatever. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, I think also some of the identity politics stuff is a kind of probably intermediate step towards an ultimate goal where it wouldn't be necessary in the first place.
There would be new problems, maybe new identities. But
I mean, I actually think of that. Yeah, I think of my own gender queer identity actually as being a kind of like thing that's suited to the current environment and to changing the current environment, but something that might not be necessary in a situation where your reproductive anatomy literally had no, literally didn't place restrictions on the kinds of rules or behavior that was expected of you.
I think that this, I'm not joking here, this type of doubt is part of our sexual identity. Sexual identity is not just a simple assignation of roles. Why? Because, I don't have time to go now into Lacanian theory, but the basic premise is that what transgender people really want to get rid of is what Lacan in his jargon calls the anxiety of castration. That you are, by entering symbolic order, you are deprived of something. And I claim you are always deprived, even with most open toilets. This is, I think, the illusion of transgenderism. Of course, okay, the problem is not they feel segregated, of course we should do this. But remember that an anxiety, if there is a good lesson of psychoanalysis, it's this one. That an anxiety is the most basic part of our symbolic social identity. Basically, you don't know what you are, and to cover this up, you escape into a symbolic identity. And the real problem is this. You love bands when they play it hard. You want more and you want it all. So get you.
So my son tells me that I'm what's known as a true scum. Do you know what that is? Have you heard that term?
It sounds familiar.
It's not just that I'm a scum, but it's actually often applied to transgendered people. People with gender dysphoria, people who actually feel they need the need to change their biology, you know, take hormones and transition. And that there's this position within the trans community that if you are not dysphoric, if you don't have that condition, you're actually not trans. That's the true scum position. And I kind of feel that that's the case, that a lot of what goes on in the name of trans politics is actually simply a radical politics of gender equity, and that it takes the guise of a fight for identity because that's the only politics we know and we know how to handle, but because it's based on liberal capitalist democratic principles like the rights of the individual.
I'm definitely familiar with the line of thought. I mean, what I'd say to the thing comment about dysphoria, I guess first I would point of clarification would be that to me that dysphoria is there's a spectrum of severity to dysphoria. So I think on the far end you have the people who have traditionally been called transsexuals who. They completely are ill at ease in the body that in their body, and they want to, they want the body of the other sex. So they want, if you're assigned male at birth, you feel completely ill at ease in a male body and you want a female body and you want to live as a woman. But there's sort of other ways of being dysphoric or lesser ways of being dysphoric. Some people may simply, you know, be dysphoric with only certain aspects of their masculinity or femininity or with certain roles that are expected of them. And of course, it's complicated. And of course, some of them will just decide that, you know, oh, I'm like a feminine man, you know, whereas other people may prefer some other identity. But to me, I also think that the other issue I take with making dysphoria so central to defining what it means to be trans is that for a lot of trans people who are living as living as their own gender, they don't have that such much dysphoria. So, you know, they may have it once, but they don't anymore. So it's sort of not like the best. It's not the.
Who are you talking about when you say people who are living as trans? Do you mean people who have actually transitioned, or do you mean
people who have transitioned to and whatever transitioning means to them, whether it means hormones, whether it means surgery, whether it just means gender expression and role?
Okay, so from what I heard there, the argument you're making is twofold. One is that there's a spectrum of dysphoria. And that, so because of that, not every treatment is necessary. If you have a low grade dysphoria, then maybe you just need to wear a slip on Sundays. And if you have a high grade dysphoria, you may need to have hormone replacement therapy and surgery. Okay. So I think that, and that's my instinct is in that range of dysphoria, I mean, the problem here is we're talking about a psychological condition, right? So it's really hard to pin down. I think we're talking about a psychological condition, that dysphoria is psychological.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So it's very hard to pin down when you have a psychological condition. No one is good at it. I mean, even the most trained professionals sometimes are often wrong. There's studies done, you know, that, for instance, you're as likely to overcome a psychological problem by talking to a friend on a regular basis about your problems as you are to a professional therapist. There's been at least some studies done like that. And there, you know, there's all sorts of questions around how to approach psychological issues. So already we're in a hornet's nest, right? I mean, we don't have a clear path.
Well, to say, so when I say that's a psychological condition, I mean it simply that in the sense of it's being a psychological state, whether it's also like a psychiatric issue, I think the answer to that question comes with whether it requires medical treatment, as it sometimes does and sometimes does it. Like I say, in my own case, I haven't yet. I mean, I've considered the hormones, but I think for me, mostly, it's about simply expressing ambiguous or feminine gender, and it's not. So I wouldn't characterize it in my condition as something that needs to necessarily involve psychiatry.
Right. Okay. So now, but I 100% support this idea that you should not only have the right, but should express gender the way that you want to, and not only just the way that you want to, but that there's actually a political reason and a moral reason even for you to wear a dress. Okay? That there's a good argument for why you should challenge traditional notions of masculinity and femininity, even today in a time when these notions seem to be weaker than ever. Let's go ahead and break them down. So I'm all for that. What I don't think I support, or what I just disbelieve, is that your identity is what's driving that. I mean, your feelings, your emotions, maybe your sexuality, maybe not. But what you like, your preferences, all of those things are driving it. But that I feel as though you could in a couple years decide to wear a suit every day and grow a beard, and you would still be you, basically, and your identity wouldn't have changed, and you would actually, you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah. Well, so identity is a pretty nebulous concept, is right. A part of the issue. And at one point, because if you try to analyze this too much, because people say isn't this just you, it's some aspect of your, isn't this just your personality, or isn't this just your sexuality or your emotions? But at some point when you strip identity of personality and sexuality and emotion, you're sort of running out of things that are left for identity to be.
Your choice. It's your empowered, active choice to change the social conditions in the world. It's not that, you as a autonomous individual, citizen, consumer have certain rights within this system. It's that you as a political agent are trying to change your conditions.
So in a sense, yes. I mean, although I don't think of it as – I think it is to some extent. It's an identity that – or genderqueer, I think, is an identity that has some political implications. But I also don't think it's primarily a political statement. I think that it's – because you could imagine someone who does decide to queer gender, as it's called, out of as a political gesture towards ending the strict binary restrictions placed on men's and women's behavior. You can imagine someone doing that simply out of a political gesture. But if it arises out of not foremost a desire to make a political statement, but instead out of some an expression of your own sort of way of experiencing your body or way of experiencing your personality or something, to me, then that makes it only – the political aspect is then secondary.
Right. Well, I don't want to reduce it down to the level of political speech.
Yeah. Neither do I.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's actually – you're trying to transform the way we live as gendered people and maybe transcend the category of gender altogether in lived practice, not just as something you're calling for, not just something that you think you have the right to talk about or even express through your mode of dress, but as a lived experience. That's your aim. You're trying to create a more equal society, and you're doing it in a way that gives you satisfaction.
Yes.
I mean, I assume that it gives you satisfaction because I watch your videos and you seem to be having a good time.
Yeah.
So I feel like what we're trying to figure out here is to what extent identity is something firm, to what extent identity is something political, and whether or not we have to ground our politics and our aims to transform the world in something that's pre-existing or not.
Well, those are pretty deep and serious philosophical questions. I mean, like,
I try to do on my little podcast.
Yeah. So I'm working on a video right now about what gender is. And it turns out to be an incredibly difficult question to answer. Mm-hmm. Once you shoot down the obvious bad answers to it and try to give some kind of actual affirmative answer. And what you find is that it's hard to answer the question without doing so for some political reason or other. And so, you know, it sort of depends, and especially since most of the people who are talking about this most are feminists. So it sort of depends what your feminist project is, how you want to characterize gender. So what does it mean to be a woman? For instance, someone like Catherine McKinnon might say that it's like simply the experience of being sexually objectified, that's constitutive of being a woman. Or someone who has more of like a queer politics.
So that means that Justin Bieber is a woman?
I you'd have to ask Catherine McKinnon.
I'm just a sucker for love. Cause honestly, the truth is that you know I'm never leaving. Cause you're my angel sent from above. Baby, you can do no wrong. My money is yours, give you a little more. Because I love ya, love ya. Me, girl, is where you belong. Just stay right here, I promise my dear. But nothing above ya, love ya. Love me, love me. Say that you love me. Fool me, fool me. Oh, how you do me. Kiss me, kiss me. Say that you miss me.